We spoke last night about reincarnation and life after death. And we spoke too about the need to articulate a new metaphysical understanding in terms of which we can think intelligently about these phenomena. And we spoke too about how the phenomenology of reincarnation and life after death is impossible to separate from the phenomenology that are studied in parapsychology. And so we're working on articulating a metaphysical framework, a way of thinking, which is adequate to everyday common sense and to science as we now know it, to an expanded science of parapsychology and to these, to the larger destiny of our personality. It turns out, rather handily, that this metaphysical understanding also allows us to wrap our minds effectively around two other phenomena which are very badly in need of explanation. And those two phenomena are self-organization and evolutionary emergence. It turns out, and I find this, it's always great when this happens, that the solution to the problem of reincarnation and life after death is also the solution to the problems of self-organization and evolutionary emergence. Now let's talk about those two phenomena. Self-organization is an idea that's become current since the 1960s. It was brought into currency by Varela and Maturana. And the idea is that when systems of entities organize in the world, at a certain point, they can become self-organizing systems. And a self, now Maturana and Varela are saying that what it means to be alive, that all the properties of life follow from the fact that life, living beings, are self-organizing systems. And a lot of scientists like that because it's sort of reductionistic, but not exactly. And so it allows us to begin to have some feeling that life can be brought into a kind of scientific mode of understanding. But the idea of self-organization is actually a little bit paradoxical when you think about it deeply. Because a self-organizing system is a system that produces the components and processes that it needs to produce the components and processes that it needs, right? And so it's recursive in that way. It's a system which is set up in such a way, homeostatic system, more or less, that takes its own existence as the variable which it holds constant. Right? Now, people talk about this idea, but nobody has any clue about how it can happen. Right? So scientists can tell us about dissipative structures. Dissipative structures are structures in reality like the ring in the bathtub that it makes as the water is going down. It's this cyclone-like feature. It's an organized system that happens when there's energetic throughput. And scientists can explain that, but they can't explain what happens when a dissipative structure makes the next step and becomes fully self-organizing, or autopoietic, you might hear it described that way. So this is one mystery that needs explaining. And another mystery, which is also deeply vexing, and that a lot of people are working on, is the problem of evolutionary emergence. How is it that in the course of evolution, new properties and new qualities emerge in the universe? Now, this seems to be a huge problem because, remember, in the scientific mode, especially the reductionistic mode of science, the idea is that all of actuality is founded on these units like atoms or quantum collapses or bits of energy or whatever it is, and that these entities, let's just stick with atoms as it's simpler, right, that these atoms have all the characteristics that they're ever going to have fully and completely forever and always. They just are what they are. So imagine a Newtonian universe, because this makes the problem really acute if we start there. Imagine this universe that's a three-dimensional grid, Cartesian grid with these little small BBs running around. And the question is, how can any combination of these little BBs ever become alive? doesn't seem possible, right? How can they become, how can hydrogen and oxygen become water if they're just atoms? Why would any spatial arrangement of BBs ever be anything but a spatial arrangement of BBs, right? So this is the problem of evolutionary emergence. How can something new come into the universe? So these two problems are really acute in the scientific world today, and I want to show this morning how the new approach that we're articulating here gives us a way of wrapping our minds around those two phenomena while simultaneously making it possible to explain parapsychology and life after death. Okay, so I want to introduce a new technical term. Right, so this is the sort of like an unveiling, right? It's like when they break a champagne bottle on a new ship, right? This is a new technical term that I am introducing. And this technical term is the waking world. Right, the waking world is just the world as we experience it when we're awake. Right. When we're not sleeping, when we're not in trance, when we're not on psychedelic substances, right? Just the waking world. And the reason this term is important is because generally we confuse the waking world with the physical world. We say, you know, we live in the physical world. And we think the physical world includes things like people and animals and lamps and pictures and so forth. But actually, it doesn't, right? The physical world is the world studied by modern physics. It's the world studied by the methods of physics. And the physical world is strictly inorganic in its nature, right? Physicists study subatomic particles and atoms and molecules, and those are all dead. They're inorganic. They're not dead, as we said last night. They're living in their own simple way, but they're inorganic. They're not living beings. And so as we look around us, right, we can see there's a physical world. There really is such a thing, right? There are these dense, inanimate objects that surround us. And even the living beings that we see have inorganic components. But the world that we see is not the physical world per se. The physical world is just atoms and molecules and quarks and fields of energy. It's not pictures and people and anything like that, right? So I want to distinguish between the physical world and the waking world. And I want to speak about the properties of the waking world, which, as we'll see, are more complex and richer than the properties of the physical world itself. But before we get into that, let's look at the physical world. Right, so just look around for a minute and notice that you're seeing a very complex picture. The kind of picture you see in a dream is what you're seeing here. Right? Entities like people and lamps are not, strictly speaking, inorganic. Something else is going on there. If we saw the way an inorganic being sees, all we would see would be fields of force, right? That's it. But we see other things. So what is this physical world? And what is the place of the physical world in the waking world? And in order to answer this question, I want to introduce the concept of grade. So last night we spoke about actual occasions. And actual occasions, as we said, are occasions on which something actual happens. Actual occasions. And we said that every actual occasion, and we ourselves are examples of actual occasions. As you listen to me, you are a sequence of actual occasions. Real things are happening. And as I speak, I am a sequence of actual occasions. But actual occasions are not all equal. They're not all alike. So the simplest actual occasions that we usually discuss are quantum collapses, subatomic particles that are instantaneous blips. But in the theory that I'm suggesting here, an atom, which is a system of, you know, of subatomic blips, is itself an actual occasion, organizing lower grade actual occasions. And then a cell is an actual occasion, organizing macromolecules and so forth. So that it's actual occasions all the way up and all the way down. But the actual occasions that organize the lower grade occasions are more complex. Right? So actual occasions come in different grades. What this means is that there isn't just matter and mind, as we usually think in Western philosophical terminology these days. But rather there are these entities, actual occasions, which are both material and mental. Right? They're drops of experience on the inside, so they're mental, but they're causally efficacious actualities on the outside. They're events on the outside, so they're physical. So the physical and the mental, right, the material and the conscious, cannot be separated. They're always together in everything actual. But actualities differ in the richness and complexity of their process. Let me make this clear. I know I haven't done it yet. So we've said that every actual occasion is a process. This is very important, right? There is no such thing as a vacuous actuality. There's nothing that just is independently of time. Everything that is, except for the abstractions and the possibilities, but every real actuality is a process. Right? It comes into being, and its life is this process of coming into being, just as we, in each moment, come into being by a process. So all entities come into being by a process. And at the inception of every actual occasion, there's an actual world out of which it emerges, just as we always find ourselves emerging out of a world that's already there. And there's every actual occasion also has a position, right? I am somewhere in the world. I'm not just in the world in the abstract, but I am right here in relation to all of you. So every actual occasion is in an actual world. It has a position. There's always a spark of consciousness. Every actual occasion is aware of itself in some way, however primitive. There's always a quantum of free will. Every actuality is a quantum of free choice. And finally, every actuality has an aim. It's going somewhere. Right? Now, we ourselves know that in every moment of our existence, we make choices. And the choices that we make have a motive behind them. Right? We act for a reason. Now, we may not be able to articulate that reason fully, but we sense it. Right? If there wasn't a reason to exist, existence wouldn't happen. So purpose, aim, or final cause, as Aristotle would have called it, is intrinsic to actuality. Now, this is very different from the scientific view, the reductionistic scientific view, which says that reality has no purpose and just is. Right? But that's not how we experience being, and we are operating on the premise that we ourselves are perfectly valid examples of what it means to be. And so the way we have a reason or a motive in our existence, so everything has an aim or a motive or a reason for existing. So that's the beginning. Every actual occasion begins with these things: an actual world, a position, a spark of consciousness, a spark of will, and an aim. We could spend forever talking about that and where it comes from and so forth, but we're just going to take that for now. And then I want to point out that once the actual occasion comes into existence, once it has its inception and it begins to function, once we begin to function in every moment, we can divide our functioning into three stages. And the first stage is that as we function, we feel the world. I'm not supposed to touch the microphone. Okay. So we feel the world. So just notice that for a minute. It's like as we emerge into wakefulness. Now here's the thing. Let's go back one more step. Moment by moment, every one of us is emerging into reality. Here we are. Here we are, right? This morning we opened our eyes and here we were. How does that happen? Where do we come from? How do we exist? We don't really know. This is a very profound mystery. It's this incredible gift. The universe births us moment to moment, and the divine births the universe, right? But here it is. So we emerge into our world, and the first thing we do is we take it in, right? The world flows in on us, and we experience the world, as Whitehead would say, conformally, which is to say that we experience the world as it was. Right? The world out of which I emerged is there for me to apprehend, and I have to apprehend it as it was, otherwise there's no continuity in the universe at all, right? So I am caused by the world, and as the world causes me, I feel it. So one of the deepest shifts in perspective that this new position involves is that it eliminates any distinction between causality and feeling. To be caused by something is to feel it. And to feel something is to be caused by it, right? So the efficient causes from the world rush in on us and we feel it. And every occasion does that. And then the next thing that happens in our emerging into actuality is that we interpret the world. Now, I invite you all to notice that each and every one of you is exactly at the center of your own universe. Exactly at the center. You may not be in the center of the room, but you're in the center of your world. And if you move across the room, you'll still be in the center of your world. You're always in the center of your world. And when you look out, when you have an experience of the world, your experience is always a mandala. Right? It's always a meaningfully ordered pattern with a clear center and a periphery. So that actual space as we experience it is always mandala-like. And so we begin with this diversity of objects spread around us in space and time. And as we take them in, we interpret them. And the result of that interpretation is the mandala-like appearance of reality. Every actual occasion experiences the world, and then it interprets the world into an appearance. There's reality and then appearance. So for every actual occasion, the world has a certain appearance. And that appearance is always and inevitably mandala-like. But the appearance can be very rich, as all of yours is and as mine is, or the experience can be very poor and abstract. So if we imagine the experience of a hydrogen atom in interstellar space, its experience is very poor, right? It probably experiences the whole universe as a gravitational gradient and nothing else, right? Whereas we have a much more elaborate experience. But every occasion constructs an appearance. And in this way of understanding, the appearance that each actual occasion constructs is causally connected to the reality out of which it emerges. Right? So the world impinges on me. As Whitehead would say, I prehend the world. It comes into me. And then I begin to pay attention to certain things and ignore other things. Certain patterns emerge from my experience of the world. Each of you emerges as a pattern, right? And so I begin to construct my appearance of the world by selective emphasis and abstraction. But what I pull from the world is causally connected to the world from which it comes. Now, in modern thought, there's this whole problem about the connection of appearance to reality. We think, well, appearance is inside and reality is outside, and there's no intrinsic connection. So in Kant, we get the idea that this is phenomenal reality, but there's a noumenal reality, a real reality which is outside of all this, right? But no, we feel the world, and from the world we abstract those features that are interesting to us, and that is the appearance of the world as we construct it. Every actual occasion of existence does that. countless times in every second, every entity in this room and in the world is constructing an appearance for itself. So the first phase of actualization is to feel the world, and the next stage is to interpret the world. Now, part of what's interesting about the interpretive process is that the way we interpret the world conditions what we know to be possible. Right? So you know, for example, when I apprehend this famous cup that we discussed last night, I see that I can pick it up and I see that I can drink from it. Those possibilities are intrinsic to the cup as it appears to me. But they wouldn't be intrinsic to the cup in the same way if my cat saw the cup, because the cat wouldn't conceptualize picking it up. It wouldn't see that range of possibility. Its appearance would be, the appearance of the world would be different for the cup, for the cat. And it'd be even more different for the table, which doesn't apprehend any of those possibilities as I set the cup down on it. So that's the first stage, is the conformal stage, the feeling stage. And the second stage is the interpreting stage. And then the third stage is the stage of decision and enjoyment. Right, so I pull the world in, I construct a picture of it, and that picture contains a halo of possibilities that venture out in all directions. And then as I become actual in this moment, I choose which possibilities I'm going to actualize, and I enjoy the value which comes from that decision. Does that make sense? So I made this little table here, which talks about actual occasions of different grade. And the point I want to make is that even though every actual occasion goes through the three stages of feeling, interpreting, and deciding, actual occasions differ in the emphasis they give to the three phases. So a low-grade actual occasion, like a hydrogen atom, just feels the world. And then it interprets it in a very abstract way. And it just does whatever it did a minute ago, right? It doesn't exercise a lot of elaborate decision making. It's very simple. But a medium grade actual occasion, let's say a cell or an organ or an animal, it feels the world, but it interprets it in a much more elaborate way. Right? We can tell that that's the case, right? A cat interprets the world more elaborately than a snail does. It perceives a greater range of possibilities, right? But these medium grade occasions, living grade occasions, don't seem to spend as much energy in deciding what to do, right? So if we get down to plants, for example, it's really clear. Plants just follow the sun, right? They experience there's a possibility of novelty. They could move this way or that way, and they just do it. But they don't really think. They just do. And the simpler an animal is, the more it just follows its impulses, as we say, or follows its instinct. So it emphasizes the first and the second stage of concrescence. Concrescence is the word that Whitehead uses to describe actualization. Concrescence means becoming concrete, becoming actual. And then high-grade occasions like ourselves, we feel the world, and we interpret the world in a very elaborate way, but then we actually think about what we're going to do next. We have an elaborate decision-making process where we consider this possibility and consider that possibility and go for the one that will yield the maximum value as we understand value at that moment. Right. So what I'm saying is that actuality, the process of actualization or concrescence, always involves these three stages, but that the emphasis placed on each stage and the richness and depth of it vary in different occasions. So we have low grade, medium grade, and high grade occasions. Does that make sense? Okay. By the way, I'm looking for a new word for this notion of grade, which is sort of an ugly word. So we could talk about that later if anybody's got some good ideas. All right. Now, here we are in the waking world, and we know that there are inorganic or low-grade occasions that play a very significant role in our world, right? They make up the walls and the couches and so forth. They make up our bodies in some way. They're important. Physics, as it's done today, is the study of low-grade occasions by high-grade occasions. Right? So here we are. We are high-grade occasions, right? We are actualizing moment to moment in this very rich way. And the atoms and the molecules, they're low-grade occasions that are actualizing in their own way. And when we study them, that's physics. Right? But of course, physics, until the quantum level, until we get to quantum mechanics, physics doesn't have any place for the high-grade occasions. It doesn't recognize them. Physics gets all involved in studying the atoms and the molecules and so forth, and then in this little arabesque of arrogance, physicists decide that's all there is, that there are only low-grade inorganic occasions. And therefore, anything in reality which looks like anything else is probably an illusion. This is not satisfying philosophical reasoning. A good philosophy does not require us to explain away our own existence, because the whole point of philosophy is to explain our own existence to ourselves. In quantum theory, the physicists begin to realize that, in fact, reality must include something other than the inorganic. Right? And you begin to get these strange ideas that the observer is somehow required. And then people think, well, maybe the human observer is the factor that makes things actually happen. Now, this is a bit absurd, but I will agree with the quantum physicists that it always takes a conscious decision to make anything actual. But what I will suggest, what Whitehead will suggest, and what many quantum theorists are now beginning to think, each occasion actually has the consciousness which makes it actual itself. Right? So each actual occasion makes the decisions by virtue of which it becomes actual. Now that has to be coordinated with quantum physics in various ways, and there's a whole project there that has to be worked out. Now, when physicists understand these inorganic occasions, they understand them in a language of mathematics. Since the late 1600s, it has been assumed that mathematics is the language of nature. But if we're going to understand nature mathematically, we have to measure it, because it's only through measurement that we can transform our experience of the world into numbers that we can manipulate mathematically. That's what measurement is, right? It's an operation which produces a number, reliably produces a number in relation to some observation. But people in our culture have not paid sufficient attention to the operation of measurement itself. How is measurement possible? And what is measurement? This is a very profound question. And it's one of the great merits of Whitehead that he devoted an enormous amount of attention to unearthing and explicating the conditions under which measurement is possible. So to make this really simple, I'll just point out that all measurement involves either a ruler or a clock. Period. Right? All measurement requires a standard. And the standards of measurement are either spatial or temporal, right? So there are rulers, which physicists suggestively call rigid rods. And then there are clocks, which physicists call periodic oscillators. They wouldn't want to say clock because it's too ordinary. We need a technical term, right? So it's a periodic oscillator. Now, if I want to measure something in time, I compare it to the ticks of a clock. If I want to measure something in space, I take some ruler, which I take to be a standard, and I count how many times I can place the ruler against whatever it is that I'm measuring. It's very simple. And it's odd when you think about it, but even when you read a dial or look at a digital readout or anything else, it all comes down to comparisons with rulers and clocks. Now, why are rulers and clocks good for measurement? The reason is that they remain what they are. A periodic oscillator, in fact, oscillates periodically. And a ruler has to hold its length. Right? We don't use rubber bands for rulers, right? Because they won't hold their length. Right? But what are the conditions under which things can either oscillate periodically or hold a rigid length? Only if they're made up of low-grade occasions that tend to persist in their habits unless they're really disturbed. Like, you could not make a ruler out of living tissue. Think about that. You can't do it because living tissue is always adapting to the environment and won't hold still to function as a standard. So we can only do measurement with inorganic entities. And basically, measurement involves comparing inorganic entities to inorganic entities. Right? So measurement is only possible in the inorganic world. Also, and this is a little more subtle, but it's interesting, in order for measurement to work, space has to be structured in a certain way. So it's like this. If I measure this chair, and I want to see if it'll fit through the front door, I have to assume that 1.5 feet over here means the same thing as 1.5 feet over there, right? That as I move in space, the definition of distance doesn't change. It does change in dreams, right? In dreams, I could measure it over here and go over there and measure it, but it wouldn't fit, right? Even though because things don't hold still that way in dreams. Things hold still that way in the waking world. And the way Whitehead conceptualizes it, he says the only way measurement can work is if we imagine the whole world is pervaded by parallel lines. Right? So there are parallel lines that'll connect the width of this chair to the width of the door by parallel lines, then the measurement stays the same. In other words, measurement is only possible in a relatively Cartesian space. We can get technical about this and talk about curvature and so forth, but we won't. But to keep it simple, if we're in a space that can be structured in terms of parallel lines, measurement is possible. Otherwise, it's not. So the inorganic world is this world of low-grade occasions operating in the context of an essentially Newtonian space. That's the inorganic world. That's the physical world. And that is not the world that we actually live in. The inorganic occasions in our waking world live in that way, but we don't. Right? We aren't like that. So suppose we say, okay, there are these inorganic entities, and they do in fact form the inorganic world. And when we're awake, we're very much involved in the inorganic world. But we are not inorganic. Right? So we are actual occasions of a higher grade. In other words, we are made out of matter that is not physical matter. I am in this moment a material being. I am as real as any atom in this room. But I am nowhere in the physical world. My existence can't be measured. In my experience, there are an infinite number of things which cannot be measured. Love and beauty and joy and hatred and depression, these things cannot be measured. Hunger even cannot be measured. It's an immeasurable experience. I am not measurable. No scientist has ever discovered a living being. All they've discovered is systems of inorganic beings. But something else happens. There is something which I am. I am a material being that is not part of the physical world. I'm something else. You are something else. Right? You are actual occasions of high grade, actual, but not physical. It's a little tricky, right? Because one of the fundamental tenets of the modern world is that the physical is the actual. that everything which is actual can be measured by a physicist. In fact, if you want to know if something is real, we go to a physicist and we say, can you measure it? Can you do it? Can you find an experiment that'll prove this? You cannot prove the existence of a human being in that way. Right? We don't exist in that way. Does that make sense? Okay. So now we see that the waking world is not the same thing as the physical world, because the waking world also includes in its operations the functioning of actual occasions of higher grade. We could call this subtle matter. You know, there's one of the interesting issues that comes up, this idea of subtle matter, or of what I call transphysical matter, has been around for a long time. And it was actually spoken about a great deal back in the 1890s and the early 20th century by the Theosophists, some of you may have heard of, who talked about transphysical worlds and transphysical matter. But no one has been able, to my knowledge, to come up with a definition of transphysical matter that really makes sense. So the Theosophists spoke about density. They said, well, solid matter is dense, liquid matter is less dense, gas is less dense, and you go on and on in this scale of density, moving up into this transphysical matter. That doesn't really work. It doesn't explain anything. Or they also, people speak about higher dimensions, which also doesn't work, because whenever you have higher dimensions, you're still operating in a context of measurement, which means that what you're talking about is still physical. But what I'm suggesting here is that the difference between subtle matter and transphysical matter is in the proportion of mind, the proportion of mental activity that's involved in it. So the higher up we go in this scale, the more elaborate the interpretation, the more elaborate the decision making, the more consciousness is involved. Once we can say that every actuality involves both consciousness and matter, that every actual occasion is a drop of experience on the inside and an event on the outside, then we can see how the proportion of the materiality and the consciousness can change. And that in certain material entities, the processing by means of which they become actual is more elaborate. There's more mind involved. And so these actualities that have more mind involved are a different kind of entity. They're still material. They're still fully actual, just like physical atoms are. But they're actual in a way that's more complex and richer. Right? So now we realize that matter itself comes in grades. There's physical matter and there's transphysical matter, both. And so in order to understand the world, we cannot try to explain everything just on the basis of physical matter. We can't do it. This is one of the major breakthroughs that we get here. It's a whole new understanding of materiality and of the role of the inorganic in actuality. So then the question is, what is the relationship between transphysical matter, between entities like us that are of higher grade, and physical matter, which is low grade? How are the causal interactions worked out between actual occasions of different grade? What I'm going to want to say, and I'll work on this more this afternoon, is that scientists have been trying to understand reality by analyzing the causal interactions among low-grade occasions. But if we accept the idea that there are various grades of matter, then we also have to look at the causal interactions among high-grade actualities and the causal interactions between high-grade occasions and lower-grade occasions. So what we're doing here is we're complexifying the network of causes which characterize actuality. We're giving ourselves a whole new set of conceptual tools with which to work with the interpretation of reality. So I want to go back a little bit now. I want to start talking about how causal interactions among different occasions work. And in particular, what I want to talk about now is how high-grade occasions like ourselves interact with lower-grade occasions like those that make up our bodies. In other words, how do we inhabit a body? Scientists are trying to say that I am my body. So they'll say, for example, that to be conscious is what it feels like to be a pattern of electrical activity in the brain. So they're trying to say that all actuality can be understood by understanding the causal interactions among low-grade actualities. I'm saying no. I am an actual occasion of higher grade. I am not physical matter. I am a different kind of matter. But if that's the case, if I am not part of the physical world, how do I control my body? How do I coordinate the activities of my body? So in order to understand that, we have to go back and remember that, let me think about this for a second here. Remember that I come into being out of a world, and the world presents to me a field of structured possibilities, things that I can do and can't do, things that are more probable and less probable. But then I make a choice about what I'm going to actualize, and that the choice that I make is always referent to my aim or my purpose in life, my purpose in this moment. Right? So aim is intrinsic, as I said, final cause is intrinsic to actuality. What is my aim? What is the general aim of all actuality? And what Whitehead says about this is that the general aim of actuality is the maximization of value in the present and in the relevant future. And what's value? Right? Value is the richness of experience, the rasa, the sap, the essence, the wonder, the enjoyment, the bliss, right? That's what the value is. And we all know that we live for value in that sense, right? We want to maximize value. That's why we make our decisions. So there's this very general aim which is built into actuality, but also each one of us has specific aims. We aim at a certain type of value. And so, for example, each one of us has a personality that's been developing over many years, and that personality expresses itself in a taste for certain kinds of value. I value intellectual understanding, and I sacrifice other values to achieve that one. Other people value artistic or aesthetic value and sacrifice some others, right? So we each have our own individual aim that we develop over time. But also, we each have social aims. And what I mean by that is that the things that we value are conditioned by our environment, by our families, by our friends, right? By our nation. Right, we have a certain set of values which comes to us from the larger social environment in which we exist. And then there are also certain cosmic aims. So for example, why is there evolution? Right? Why is there, as Teilhard would say, a drive toward complexity and interiority? Why do things become more evolved? There's an aim. Somehow built into every actualization, there's this aim at greater value, right, which comes to us from the divine. And so the aims that influence our existence come from our past and from our society and from the cosmos and from the divine. Right? And it's in terms of our aims that we evaluate the possibilities that are available to us. Now, what I want to suggest is that we influence the aims of the actual occasions making up our bodies. So that we actually shift the taste for value of our cells and of our organ systems. So that when I decide to move my arm, somehow my cells start wanting those processes that will lead to the movement of my arm. I persuade my cells to move because I influence their aim. So the occasions that are larger than I am, that organize society and organize Gaia and organize the universe, right? They affect the choices that I make. And I, in turn, affect the choices that my cells make by influencing their aim, their desire, what they want. So we can now see the whole universe as this hierarchy of actual occasions in which the larger ones persuade the activities of the smaller ones, or the lower grade ones, so that they begin to organize in new ways. Now, let me talk about this in terms of a single cell. What we know from science is that cells are vast collections of macromolecules, very complex molecules. And scientists have discovered that even in the laboratory, they can bring about dissipative systems of macromolecules, and that these dissipative systems will actually draw their own boundaries and they can create little sacs around themselves and so forth. But that's not quite life. Scientists have not figured out how to create life. Now, when there is life, there are three things that cannot happen as a simple result of the organization of macromolecules. And the first one is, whenever there's life, whenever there's a cell, it has its own central consciousness. Right? Now, we'll talk later about how we can know that, but we do know that every cell has its own consciousness. People who are work with cells under microscopes, they say that if the cell was big enough, they'd make it a pet. It's just like a living being, right? It actually is just like a living being. So it's living, right? It has its own centralized consciousness. And a cell pursues possibilities that would not make any sense to a macromolecule, right? So there's a cell in a Petri dish, and there's food over there, and there's not food over there, and the cell will sense the gradient and move toward the food. Macromolecules don't do that. They don't think that way, right? In other words, the cell has a deeper penetration into the halo of possibility that always surrounds every actual world. And then also the cell manifests qualities that a macromolecule can't manifest, right? It moves in different ways. It appears in different ways, right? So, and then also the cell coordinates the spontaneities of the macromolecules. Right? I'm convinced that if we examine the behavior of molecules and cells, we'll find out that they move in different ways than macromolecules do outside of the cells. Because the behavior of the macromolecule is not totally determined. This is what a quantum theory teaches us, is that there's always indetermination in every moment of actuality. The momentum and the position of the macromolecule is not determined by its past. There's this realm of freedom. And that the macromolecule, the consciousness of the cell, influences the aim of the macromolecule so that it begins to behave differently than it would. And it's through the influence of the cell consciousness that the macromolecules become a self-organizing system. Right, so what I'm suggesting here is that the phenomena of self-organization, that the way in which scientists now explain life, a self-organizing system, that in itself can only be explained by the intervention of actual occasions of higher grade. Making sense to you? Yes. Right? So now we can explain self-organization, which nobody else can explain. We can now explain it for what it's worth in terms of higher grade actualities. And we can also explain evolutionary emergence. In other words, new properties and new modes of behavior emerge in the course of evolution as higher grade actualities emerge in evolution. So we're not stuck with the properties of the atoms or the molecules, and we don't have to derive everything else from those. because in fact we realize that every actuality surveys a range of possibilities and decides among them. And the higher the grade of the actuality, the larger the field of possibilities which it surveys, and the larger its behavioral repertoire will be. Right? So evolutionary emergence can be explained as the appearance of higher and higher grade actualities in the evolutionary advance. It's no longer incoherent. So now we come back to the waking world, the one that we experience, the one that we are experiencing. And the waking world, as we know from physics, in fact consists of physical, inorganic molecules. They're really there. They're actual, fully actual. And it consists of higher grade actualities, transphysical matter, matter which can never be identified by the current methods of physics. Not there in that sense. But clearly it's part of the waking world. And we see all around us that these higher grade actualities change the appearance and the actuality of the physical, right? So we have technology and we have art and we have human beings and we have life, all of which radically transform the waking world, so that the waking world cannot be explained in terms of mere physical principles. We have to bring in these other principles. And with this perspective, we can explain self-organization, the emergence of life, and evolutionary emergence in general. And as we'll see this afternoon, we can also then begin to explain parapsychology and life after death using this model. Okay, that's lecture for this morning, and I'd love to discuss it with you.
Is this causation from higher grade occurrences or actualities to lower grade a top-down, one-way hierarchy of influence, or is it both ways?
It's definitely both ways, although it appears to be somewhat asymmetrical. So that what I would suggest is that the higher grade occasions influence or persuade the lower grade occasions by shifting their values. We'll talk about this more later, but there are different types of cause. One type of cause is efficient cause. So you're over there, and you said some words, and I hear them. Right? That's an efficient cause. I hear the words that you said, and I am compelled to hear the words that you actually said. But the other kind of influence is persuasion. Right? It's like suggesting a possibility or shifting a mood. Right? And so what I'm suggesting is that the higher grade occasions shift the mood, as it were, of the lower grade occasions, shift their taste. They still have freedom, but their freedom is now constrained by this different sort of persuasive environment. And so there's this kind of final cause that gets sent down, whereas the lower grade occasions influence the higher grade efficiently. Whatever they become is binding on the higher grade occasion, just the way your words are binding on me. And so there's a difference, but Whitehead makes a big distinction between persuasion and compulsion. Right? Like if I want you to cross the room, I can pick you up and carry you, that's compulsion. Or I can suggest, will you please walk? In which case you still have your freedom, but you might do what I want. So the higher grade occasions persuade the lower grade occasions, but lower grade occasions are binding on the higher. I'm not sure that's the whole story, but that's the emphasis that I'm noticing.
Well, I have a very specific application mm-hmm. of understanding this mm-hmm. in terms of collective consciousness.
Yes.
So we're studying the effects of collective consciousness on yes. society and the environment.
Yes.
Being an engineer, I'm more interested in the application, the practical yeah. application of yeah. it. So when people get together and do a million-person global meditation or right. prayer event for world peace,
right.
are you suggesting then that what's driving that is the Gaia consciousness, and that individuals then are being influenced towards more socially coherent behavior in these actions because the larger level, the macro level, the highest grade of the biosphere living biosphere mm-hmm. is actually driving the individuals to take that action?
Again, it's a great question, and I don't have a full answer, but here's what comes up right now. There is a Gaia consciousness, and it is a sequence of actual occasions, right? So that every pulse of the planet is one actual occasion. And that higher consciousness persuades the individuals. It shifts their values. And so if Gaia is wanting, let's say, this healing, then individuals like you might be inspired to produce, to organize a million person meditation, right? And that in turn would have an effect on the Gaia consciousness, right? So it's reciprocal in that way. But you see, what's important here is not that I have an answer to that question, but rather that I'm suggesting a language in which that question can be asked, right? And so what I'm hoping is that if you describe your question in terms of the language that I'm offering, it will help you think of new ways to answer the question, perhaps new experiments and so forth. Because if you try to describe what's happening in terms of modern science, you get nowhere. The whole idea of a group meditation isn't even intelligible to a regular physicist, right? So here I'm presenting a language which will allow you to understand physics in this language, but also allows the question you just asked to be formulated in a new way that brings it in relation to physics. But exactly what the answer is, I don't know. Right? That's what's fascinating. Right? Now we can begin to see, can we formulate your question in a way which allows us to test it in some way? That's the hope, right? That it gives us a language in terms of which we can form a new science. So your question is perfect, but I want to suggest that you take it and run with it and work out an answer in terms of this.
You started off by talking about the waking world.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I'm getting a little ahead of you here, but you're going to be talking, you've started talking about the subtle realms.
Mm-hmm.
Is that part of the waking world?
No, not exactly. Well, we'll talk about that this afternoon. Yeah. That's a complicated question. But in general, what I want to say right now is that no, right now what we're seeing is the waking world. Perhaps when we're dreaming or out of body, we're in the transphysical worlds. But by the waking world, I mean just the world that we experience when we're awake in our normal state of consciousness.
You were talking about the macromolecules and the cell.
Yes.
And the macromolecule is going to behave in a particular way when it's not part of the cell.
Yes.
And then when it becomes part of the
yes.
cell, the more complex entity persuades it to behave in a different
yes,
way.
Yes, exactly.
Where did that more complex entity come from?
Ah, that's a good question. We'll talk about that later, but just very briefly, there are two theories about this, both of which are plausible. One is that as the world becomes complex enough, it generates these higher grade occasions. And the other one is that they pre-exist already in the transphysical worlds and enter into the physical world when the conditions are right. But we'll talk about that this afternoon.
I noticed some similarities between Whitehead's philosophy mm-hmm. and Teilhard.
Oh, very much.
There's a lot of crossover, different terminology, but similarity
yes.
in ideas. Does Whitehead have any equivalent to the Omega point?
No.
No.
Which is quite interesting. So one of the most wonderful features of Teilhard is the way he talks about the within and the without, mm-hmm. that every without has a within. But he speaks about it in a very general term. He just says, since we have a without and a within, everything must have a without and a within. What Whitehead gives us is a marvelous, very detailed, and highly technical exploration of how that is, of what the within does, and of what the without does, and how it works, right? And also, this scheme of high-grade actualities is exactly what Teilhard refers to when he talks about the law of complexity consciousness. Right? This is really interesting. Right? But Whitehead is not really evolutionary in the same sense that Teilhard and Sri Aurobindo are, because he's dealing at this huge level. If you get to the very, very biggest possible level, all the universes, right? There's an endless succession of universes, all of which are striving toward value, But no finite universe ever fully realizes all the value that's possible. And so it's this kind of steady state universe at the largest scale. But obviously, our universe, our local universe, what Whitehead calls our cosmic epoch, it is an evolutionary scheme. And it's going somewhere. And we could account for that by the whole thing being part of one high-grade society, and Omega would be some culmination of that. And so what Whitehead doesn't talk about that. So what Thomas Berry told Brian Swim, and what Brian Swim told me, is that Whitehead has the philosophy and the analysis, but Teilhard has the story. And Whitehead doesn't have the story. He just wasn't thinking at that level, right? So in a certain sense, you know, it's almost like Whitehead sets a really solid philosophical foundation for Teilhard's story. Yeah, but they're remarkably compatible, you know. And in fact, there's Teilhard de Chardin, Alfred North Whitehead, John Gebser, and Sri Aurobindo, who I think were the four greatest thinkers of the 20th century, and they're all remarkably compatible one with the other. They were all bringing into the planetary sphere a new intellectual dispensation that we're exploring here together.
I was thinking of what Brian told us and Robert McDermott was in the Teilhard class, that Teilhard and Whitehead never met each other and never knew of each other. Mm. And suddenly you find out, but of course there were other thinkers that influenced both, but you find out suddenly that the whole atmosphere of thought in the planet starts moving towards a particular, in a particular direction, and of people that have not seen each other, and then you read your thought or you analyze your thought, and they overlap in an amazing way.
Exactly.
And then you can think, well, where is that influence? Where is that atmosphere of thought coming from?
That's right, and it's coming from the Gaia, from Gaia herself. Right, and so Gaia has a need, right? There's a certain kind of value that she needs, right? And then these thinkers respond to that, right? They're sensitive to it, and then they do their work, and their work enables other people to become more sensitive to it.
Would you hypothesize on the mechanism or medium through which that communication from these actuality occur, since we're talking beyond physics anyway? Are we looking at like a morphogenetic field like Sheldrake talks about, or is it a consciousness field if such a thing exists?
Well, I guess what I want to say is that the ability of actual occasions to influence the aim of lower grade occasions is a metaphysical primitive. It's just the way it is. I wouldn't want to, you know, I'm not going to try to explain it in terms of physics, because I'm trying to explain physics in terms of this, right? And so, and I think that the morphogenetic idea is really interesting and might be useful in this context, but this particular thing is not a morphogenetic relationship. It's sui generis. See, I'm suggesting that there is, in reality, the capacity of higher grade occasions to influence the aims of lower grade occasions. It's just a causal, primitive causal relationship. I'm not going to try to explain it in terms of everything, anything else. I'm going to try to explain other things in terms of this. any scheme of explanation has to assume something. I'm assuming this. And as we'll see, I don't know what the limits of this are. So, for example, we talked yesterday about macro psychokinesis, about the capacity of a human being to make a table lift up in the air. And we're assuming that's possible. Right? Now, the only way that's possible, right now science can't explain it at all. I'm suggesting that an adequately structured human being can influence the aim of the molecules making up the table, so that they can exploit the very remote quantum probability that they could levitate, and they'll do it. What are the limits of that? I don't know. If people can make a table, if table raise up off the floor, they can defy gravity this way. What are the limits? Clearly, we do it in our bodies, but what are the limits? I don't know what mediates this, and I'm suggesting that this is just, we just take this as primitive. And so, you know, it's an interesting question. We could talk about it more, but basically, I don't want to interpret it in something else. I want to interpret other things in terms of this.
There is a notion, a friend of mine is a physicist, but a non-traditional physicist, mm-hmm. developing a mathematically based, what he calls a physics of light.
Mm-hmm.
And he calls it the biophysics of the quantum plenum, on a foundational basis that space is not empty.
Mm-hmm.
He calls it the plenum of space, not mm-hmm. a vacuum of space.
Mm-hmm.
And that every point in space is infinite energy.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually is very consistent with what you're talking about
here. Yes and no. You see, because this is hard to communicate, but he's assuming that there's space, which is something out there, and that space is possessed of energy, which is something out there, and that somehow this plenum of space produces events.
No, really. That's kind of extending the physics model to the way he's talking about it.
Yeah.
But
what I would suggest is that as an actual occasion, I take in the entirety of my past. Now, let's get really sophomoric about this for a minute, okay? From a certain point of view, you only know about the world from your experience. And so the world that you know is the world in your experience. So there's a certain way in which each one of us can say, I contain the world. I'm in the mathematical center of the world, as I said before, and I contain it. The world exists in my experience. The way that I'm speaking takes that really seriously, right? I contain the entire universe, including you, as of a second ago. You contain the whole world, including me, as of a second ago. That's all there is, right? Actuality is contained in experience. Experience is not contained in anything. The space of experience is all the space there is. As Whitehead says, outside of experience, there is nothing, mere nothing. So there's no space apart from experience, no space apart from consciousness, no space apart from aim. That's it, right? So this, we can't talk about space as a precondition for actuality, because actuality is all the space there is. Make any sense? Yeah, so I usually find that I differ with people who are constructing physics models, and this understanding of space is different.
Yeah. Taking experience as the basis, then Whitehead would definitely be categorized as a pan-experientialist?
Yes.
What is the difference between a pan-experientialist and panpsychism?
Nothing. It's just terminology.
Nothing. It's just terminology.
You know, there's in the conventional science of mind, the big debate is everything matter? Is everything mind? Or do they both exist? And then there's a fourth position, which is called the panpsychist or the pan-experientialist position, which is what I'm presenting. And that position is that they're never separate, is that without mind, there is no matter. And without matter, there is no mind. And that's called panpsychism or panexperientialism. Those are just different words for the same thing. It just depends on which one you find more elegant. But there's no difference whatsoever. It's the same position.
Seems like this is a question that'll come up later in the day, but like taking God as an actual occasion or something higher than us.
Yeah.
And something like a cell. Is that just an emphasis of like more mental, less physical, like more transparency?
The model that I'm presenting here implies a kind of infinite hierarchy of actual occasions of higher and higher grade, right? So in a certain sense, the whole universe becomes a sequence of actual occasions in some way. God is something else. And I'm really deliberately bracketing out the theological questions in this particular weekend, just because it's just a whole other discourse, right? Just we'd have to approach it in a very different way.
So maybe taking God out of it and just some actual occasion that's ordering me. Mm-hmm. I'm associating myself with something, and there's something higher in the hierarchy.
Yes.
Can't I become aware of myself as something higher in that hierarchy? Or am I sort of, where do I stop?
That's a really interesting question. The way I'm presenting it today is that we are just at the level we're at. We are just these actual occasions that exist moment to moment. And so we would be influenced by the aim of the higher grade occasions. But the model I'm presenting today doesn't provide for what you're talking about. That question you're asking is very closely related to the question of reincarnation. Because the question, there are different ways to understand reincarnation. It could just be a sequence of actual occasions that jumps across lifetimes. Or it might be that we are part of a soul, and that this soul is somehow other than our personality. And if we are part of a soul, which is somehow connected with the universe and connected with the transcendent, then indeed there are all these yogic possibilities of our own transcendence, which I definitely think and believe, right? But as I said, for this weekend, I'm just not going there because I'm just trying to cover this particular piece of the territory. Maybe we can do another weekend sometime and talk about the theology because it's really important and really interesting and has huge implications. But I'm just trying to bracket it out because there's so much to cover this weekend.
Is that theology necessarily a limitation in understanding transcendence, even in the terms that I understand you saying? In other words, becoming aware of yourself on a more complex or higher grade level, isn't necessarily theological. Doesn't need God in there to expand awareness to recognize a higher transcendent state.
Let me say this. The model that I'm presenting is not adequate to deal with the possibility of transcendence in that way. I'm talking at the level of the personality. I'm not talking at the level of the soul. Right? So the soul, I would say, is that element in us which is a divine spark, basically, and which has the capacity to experience ourselves universally and transcendently. But I'm talking about the personality, which is a personally ordered sequence of high-grade actual occasions. Now, that personality is just what it is, and it's not going to transcend. But we are more than that. But I'm not talking about that part of us this weekend, right? And so it just requires different conceptual resources. Now, if you don't like God, we could maybe find a different word for it, but it does require something bigger. See, I like God too, yeah, so. So, you know, but so I think we do that if we're going to, we're talking about this weekend at a very particular level, right? The objective is to find a metaphysical framework which is compatible with science, but allows us to discuss self-organization, evolutionary emergence, parapsychology, reincarnation, and life after death. And I'm doing the minimum I can to encompass that, which is not very minimal, but it's still less than I could do, right? But then if we want to go deeper and broader and discuss possibilities of enlightenment and possibilities of yoga and discuss the actual origin of actual occasions and so forth, then we have to step back into a bigger picture and approach it in a different way, which I'd love to do on another occasion, but not this weekend.
So does the, you know, at the level of the personality, I can recognize myself as an individual human sitting here in this skin on this couch.
Right.
I can also recognize myself as a member of this community.
Right. That's right.
I can also recognize myself as part of any other affiliation.
That's right.
Part of a, you know, a club or right. Some other professional organization. Or I could recognize myself as a part of the human species.
Exactly.
So is that level of personality recognition
yes.
within the,
yes.
this model?
Absolutely.
Okay.
You know, it's tricky working with conceptual models. And I'm presenting a set of abstractions, and as I said last night, every set of abstractions is germane to a certain set of interests, right? So I'm presenting a set of abstractions germane to these particular interests, which are also the ones that are relevant to the survival group at Esalen, So it's not just here, right? So, but this is interesting, right? And then another occasion, we'll take a broader view and approach it with a more spiritual interest. And then we'll see that there's another set of abstractions very closely related to this, but somewhat different, which open up to the larger existential situation.